Supervisor.
This is the Music Supercast.
It's in my interest, in ours perhaps, for me to smoke a joint and calm down.
Hosted by Supergroup's Mary Prankster and lead music supervisor David Heyman. Recorded out of their Toronto and LA headquarters. Produced by Sorrel Sound and all vetted by me, Amani Sabri. Check out the Supercast blog at wearethesupergroup.com/MSC and don't forget to share.
I think I got my swagger back.
And over the years, we just got to be closer, and he got to watch and know what I was trying to do as a musician, and I got to watch the choices he made as an artist who was already a well-known artist, and the pressure that comes with that, but also the risks that he took and the chances he said no to, things that he said no to that he didn't, you know. It was interesting, you know. Walk a couple miles to the water
and hold under the table, gonna drink the town. Welcome back to the Music Supercast. Been on break. Missed you all. That break is because we are jammed. We're so busy. We've got so much going on. I just couldn't dedicate the time that I really wanted to for the podcast. I want to meet with interesting people, musicians that I love, filmmakers, media, producers, all sorts of people involved in music and film. That's what I love. That's what I want to talk about. But it's been just crazy here, crazy busy. And I apologize for the delay, but we're back and we're going to make a discerned effort to put out a podcast. I've already got a bunch banked. We've got Junior T, Young Gov coming up. We've got some amazing stuff lined up, and I want to bring it all to you. I want to bring my friends. I want to bring the community from here, Los Angeles, everywhere in between, the world of sync, the world of music and film. But I've been busy, so I apologize. Been busy with a show called Utopia Falls. I'm not going to tell you much, but it's going to be on Hulu 2020. And shouts to RT, the creator, the director, the showrunner, the mastermind behind this thing, working with Boy Wonder and Nikhil Sitharam, who's been just working literally around the clock for an entire year to get this composition right. It's a music-heavy show, and it's been heavy. Let's just put it at that. 2020 coming out. Ginny and Georgia Kaya is working every day, all the time on this new Netflix show. It's a big one, and you're going to love it. If you love Gilmore Girls, if you love sort of quirky comedies, and it's sort of geared towards young people, so it's safe and fun for the whole family. Ginny and Georgia coming out in 2020. I have a show called Nurses that's coming out as well. And a series called For the Record, which celebrates albums, vinyl, wax, and the music that we love. We just finished up the final season of Schitt's Creek, Letterkenny's ongoing, Kim's Convenience. We are back, and please send us your music, Toronto. We want to keep you involved in this very, very local show. We're working on Burden of Truth and a couple of HBO pilots that we cannot talk about. We've got some films coming out. Big shouts to Adele Ho in Los Angeles office, who just finished a film called Yellow Rose. 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. You must see this film. You must. Once We're Brothers will be in theaters soon. That's the Robbie Robertson, the band documentary. And I would love if you emailed in your opinions. I'm sure there will be many from this audience. I have my own, and we're going to talk to Daniel Roher soon, the director of that film. We have a film called Carmen, a Maltese film, 13 Minutes, an Oklahoma film that Scotty Taylor is working on as Music Soup. The rest of us just got American distribution, so really happy to see that film taking flight. And my movie, States, will be coming at you, Toronto, in February. So more details on that soon. So as you can see, we are extremely busy here at the Supergroup, but we want to give you great content, and we wanted to kick off this season with one of my favorite gentlemen, one of my favorite voices, and one of my favorite minds in music and film. Ben Dickey, who played Blaze in the 2018 film by Ethan Hawke, celebrating the life and struggles, times, outlaw world of Blaze Foley, played so beautifully by Ben Dickey. That's all I gotta say, because we cover it all, my friends. So without delay, I'm going to just go right into it. Let's jam. Me, Ben Dickey, at the H Club in Los Angeles. Shouts to the H Club, shouts to Adele, and shouts to the audience for coming back to the Music Supercast. I love you all. I appreciate you. Big love.
Play the
So welcome to the Music Supercast, Ben Dickey.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to my swanky room at the H Club.
I'm right above you.
This
room looks just the same. All right.
Same layout.
I don't have that little basket over there, though.
You can borrow it. They won't notice. Yeah. Actually, I brought that all the way from Toronto.
Oh, good.
I brought you moose droppings.
Oh, yeah?
I brought you moose shit, man.
Shit, man.
I thought it'd be perfect.
Those look delicious.
They are delicious, man. I enjoy.
I will. I was looking at them. I was waiting. Is this for me? I'm going to eventually open that.
We try and bring the Canadiana wherever we go at the Supergroup.
I love Canada. I spent a lot of time in Canada.
Oh, for real?
Oh, yeah. Nova Scotia. I spent at least 10 like summers up there, like multiple months. And Cape Breton as well, just like roaming around, playing music up there.
It's my favorite place in the world.
Oh, it's magical.
The East Coast of Canada.
It's magical.
Right?
Yeah, all that Maritimes world is magical.
Did you dig into any of the music scene there?
Yeah, man. The first time that my band Blood Feathers made a record, Ethan has a place up there, my buddy Ethan Hawk, and it's like right near Port Hawkesbury.
Okay.
And
named after Ethan,
of course. Of course, that's why I did it.
Yeah, of course.
Like, this is pretty much my name, right? But he's got a place up there, and I had a band called Blood Feathers. We're making our second record, and he said, "Why don't you make a record up there? You want to go up to my house?" And so we used his house for like 2 months. But
Big Pinked it.
Yeah, totally. We were trying to like find that sort of world, and it was very that world. But there's a guitar pool every Thursday with these fellas who play, and they are all excellent. You know, they all play two or four, five or six songs, you know, every time. But it's so passionate and so much fun. And the first time that we went to Cape Breton, a friend of ours was like, "I'm going to take you to Kaylee and we're going to watch and I'll see if y'all can play." Well, this thing had been booked for ages and there were thousands of people there. You don't just like walk up, you know, you're going to get, you know, like, and
yeah.
They were like, "Of course."
That's how it goes
there,
man.
Of course you can play.
Anyone could.
The three guitar players played with this huge band that just, like, what chords are you guys using? It was so much fun, man.
So we're going to go way back now.
Yeah, yeah.
February 1st, 1989, where were you?
I was probably at my mom's house. My parents got divorced, so I was probably at my mom's house. You know, I had a paper route. So odds are I never rode my bike when it was like really cold out, and that was a particularly cold street. It was like sleeting in Texas, so you can guarantee that it was snowing in Arkansas. So I was probably with my mom in her warm car as she took me on my paper route. I thought about that a lot.
And on the news, there was nothing on the news.
No, not that I would have caught.
Yeah, because, you know, the news of an outlaw like Blaze Foley dying doesn't make the mainstream.
No,
news.
But you know what's
sort
funny?
Sort of just happens. Right?
Yeah, yeah. What's funny with me and my connection with Blaze that continues to be amazing is, no, there was no news coming out at that level, but come to find out there were people in my life who knew about it because they knew him. And I found that out, you know, after we'd been working on it for a while.
Right.
And that just continues to be mind-blowing to me.
We'll definitely get into that. But yeah, in 89, when you were a young man, were you aware of that stuff? That kind of music, even?
Yeah, I mean, sure. Like, that just is like, I was obsessed with music. My whole world was music. There's a fellow called Jason D. Williams, who's kind of like Jerry Lee Lewis 2.0. And one of my first shows was going to see him, but he's still around, Jason D., and he's absolutely amazing. My first shows was seeing him turn a place inside out. So going to a smoky bar and just seeing performers was something that was on my peripheral, and I was up in by the time I was 10, 11, 12. And I had a guitar by that time, too, so I was obsessed with him.
Sounds like an East Coast story. That's the way it goes, man. Yeah. And so, that was in Arkansas.
That's in Arkansas, yeah.
And when did you move to Louisiana?
Well, I moved to Louisiana in 2014.
2014. Okay, yeah, so the formidable years were really in Arkansas, I mean, in those circles.
Like. So, when I turned 20, I moved to Philadelphia, and I was in Philadelphia until I was, you know, 36.
Right.
So that like, I got...
Did that stymie you from that, like, lifestyle of sort of...
No, I mean, I had a rock and roll band, you know, I used to play open mic nights and play a second pass just playing Mississippi John Hurt songs, and, you know, I did both. I still want to play rock and roll. That's what I'm after.
Yeah.
I have a rock and roll daydream, you know, it's pretty big. But
you like the band. You like.
I love a band. I like the mysterious things that happen with a band, and how much fun it is to be with people who are as into a groove or a rhythm as you are, and you roll together. It's a pretty magical feeling. But you can create it on your own, and you can create a relationship with people in the audience that kind of makes them part of it too, where they're playing a little bit too. But yeah, that's always been my aim. But the whole time that I had rock and roll bands, and including when I was in Arkansas and playing like super loud Marshall half stack punk rock, like math rock, I still wanted to turn everybody on the front porch with an acoustic guitar.
Do you have those recordings still?
Yeah. I have a lot of my recordings.
We're going to drop one of them now, man. We're going to pull some history out of
Shake Ray Turbine, man. Put some Shake Ray Turbine on.
Fucking A, man. So, you know, you're coming up was definitely focused around the live performance, that thing, you know, being on the stage in front of the people in your town and being recognized and whatnot. But the world that we're introduced to from music, at least someone like me who comes from a place where it's not like that. It's not fluid like that. It's not creative. I come from like Canadian suburbs, you know. So all of my music is canned. It's there forever. It's golden. And that's why I love what I do, because I get to go dive deep, 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 deep.
Yeah, right on.
So when did you discover the alchemy that is the singularity of the music you make now, which has more of a resonance beyond just live performing? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I really do believe that all I'm doing today versus what I did ever before is going through a different form and sanding down the same tool. I mean, I learn how different ways of making music you can hypnotize yourself into. I'm always searching for the place where you get hypnotized.
Sure.
It's the same thing as hearing someone read you a poem and something twists in you when someone delivers that line. I'm looking for that all the time. So in regards to like my relationship with what I'm trying to say or do, it's not much has changed. I'm learning more, which should help me. I've got more information.
But the idea of distilling it and taking that beyond just, you know, live performance.
Yeah.
Now you're seeing that with the movie Blitz.
Sure. Yeah. It's just all different forms of expression. I mean, Ethan had encouraged me to act because he thought that I would maximize that principle. I didn't think I wanted to act because I was thinking acting was something that it wasn't. Do you know what I mean? I mean, go on.
I kind of know what you mean. What is acting compared to performing? Songs, your words, your own words, and then you're going up and...
The way I look at the world is we're all singing. Well, you and I are singing together right now. It's all a big song.
Sure.
I mean, that is really the way I look at it, and I don't mean to sound too swami about it. But I do. I mean, acting turns out I use the same muscles, same tools that I do. And I recognize the rhythm and the sound of life when I'm doing it. So, you know.
But you're picking up not on your own story, you're picking up on the actors, because acting is all about reacting.
Yeah.
So being there without.
It's just present, you know. Yeah, it's acting is preparation, 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 and then making sure you stay alive on camera. Because if you die, the preparation will be gone.
Well, your performance was far from flat. It was beyond compelling. You know,
I appreciate that.
And you had those formative years in your hometown, and then you come to Los Angeles with Ethan at that point. Like, where did you meet Vincent D'Onofrio?
Ethan did a play called Hurley Burley in the 2005 or six. And I met Vince the first time there in New York. And I sort of met him, he came to a couple New Year's Eve. So we've been knowing each other, kind of friends of friends. Oh, I remember you and such. In 2013 or 14, we just had the opportunity to spend some more time together and got to visit. And, you know, we just fond of one another, friends. And then when Ethan had this idea, he sort of sent me to Vince. And Vince is an intense individual.
I can imagine.
Yeah, and I've known that about, and I respect, I mean, he's also sweet, and he's also really smart and kind.
Sweet big dudes, man.
Yeah. But when it comes to being somebody who wants to talk to you about a craft that they've been involved in, he'll dare you to defy what your intentions are. So why are we doing this? You know, that kind of thing. But
it's so important to question.
Yeah,
I mean, you're laughing it off, but that is what we do in filmmaking.
Yeah,
because it, you know, whether it goes back to the auteur, Ethan, whoever the directors, and what it's not what they want, because what they want is the story.
So right.
Every decision made, from props to art department to music,
right,
it all goes back. How do we help serve this story?
That's exactly right.
And acting too, you have to be more present than the actual moment to understand how it fits into the storytelling.
Right, and all the secrets that you find, you know.
So you studied with Vincent? You like went down and did workshops with him?
I had like 3.5 hour sessions where I had to learn like a 3.5 minute monologue and under his direction perform it in dozens of different ways.
Right on.
And
so we did like purple belt and black belt and you're ready for the film?
I think the lesson was when you learn the words and all that stuff is in you, then the performance comes through you.
Right.
And once you have those words, you're just pushing the preparation of knowing the words through a performance. So when I tell you I want you to read, I was reading a sad monologue.
Sure.
He's like, do it to me like it's the best news you've ever heard. And immediately after I do a 3.5 minute monologue, he says, do it now flat with no space in between, you know. Once, if the writing is bad, or if the writing is beautiful, or if the writing is sparse, or if you're supposed to be saying jib-jab nonsense, just having the preparation of it in you, you can go anywhere in the room with it.
Absolutely.
But if the person you're working with wants to make a scene more amped up, if you're arguing or something, you just have to have the ability to move through the words.
Absolutely. This is kind of like a jam band.
he spoke to me in very musical terms. But rather than, you know, rather than go fishing for what inflection you're going to put on what run of words and sentences, or where you're going to really show your emotion, by the time I get to when I say Kingsport, I'm going to really be yelling by that point. If you start to architect the scene like that, you've cooked yourself because you can't be agile to what is different about the other person's performance. And you'll be performing against nothing but this plan that you've had.
Right.
That's not the way life works. If you go talk to somebody, you don't
know what their answer is going to be.
Right.
You can't project the whole.
You might have been mad that you didn't give me that Celtic ticket, but there's a story behind that. You know.
And so those words you speak of, written by Ethan Hawke and Sybil Rosen, right? And Sybil plays her.
Alia.
So she plays her wonderfully in the movie.
Yeah, she does.
And she has a bit of a musical background, like a lot of actors in Hollywood.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think she can play. I think she's played a musician before in films.
Yeah, but she can play some bass lines.
She's a bass player. Don't get me started, Ben.
Yeah.
I just started bass, and it's like, I don't even want to start. Love bass players.
Jameson, man.
Better of a van and a hot mom. That's all I'm saying. But she, how did you and her connect musically, because to make it feel so fucking real?
Well, you
did
know,
you workshop with her the same way?
We were so lucky making this movie because she was our first choice for Sybil, and she said yes.
Nice.
And we had our first meetup in like September. We started filming in December. We had a meetup.
Is that because you knew her and you knew, or just knew her work?
We knew her work, and Ryan, Ethan's wife and producer in Blaze, she was like, this is the person, and we were all like, oh wow, yeah, perfect, yeah, what do you think?
It's amazing.
So when we had our first meetup, of course that was an important thing, and I was nervous. I knew Ethan's integrity came with the invitation, so I knew that we were doing okay there, but you know, she was being pitched something pretty unique, because to play opposite somebody. So when we met, it was formal, and at Ethan's production office in Brooklyn, and I played Clay Pigeons on a guitar sort of after we had a little, like a minor little read through and visit. She had known that song. Michael Cera recorded that song on one of his records, and they're super tight buddies. And so I don't know how Mike discovered Blaze, but she was keen to Blaze already, which is amazing, you know?
Mike's a Canadian, so we just crate dive all day long, and that's what we do.
That's dope. So, she sang it with me, and as soon as she started singing, I was like, oh, you're a singer. Rad. I didn't know that. And
then
like knockout.
Dove. Yeah.
Ooh, just so good. So we went back to Ethan's house and had some supper and like had some drinks, and we just started playing songs together. And on a person level, we clicked off very quick, but singing together and like Allie is, you know, really sharp and present. And she, when she's like wants to sing, she's present for the song. And when she's in a scene, she's present for the scene. So as soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, you're a serious cat.
Mm-hmm.
And her generosity of acting on in a movie with so much emotion with somebody who'd never done it before, she was extraordinarily helpful. I mean, extraordinarily helpful.
Right. And, you know, to me, it sort of fills in. And when I see now that you're touring or jumping on spots with John Prine.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of fills out. It kind of like light bulbed for me that connection with ladies.
Yeah.
And, you know, because he's got Connie Smith and Iris on stuff.
Beautiful.
Trisha Yearwood, like Emmylou Harris.
Casey Musgraves.
Yeah. You know, like that's, and that's his thing. That's when I love John Prine the best is, you know, so... To me, it filled out, you
yeah,
know, that.
Yeah, yeah.
Had you ever duetted before?
Yeah, you know, having made, like, guitar pulls be part of how I spend my time.
Sure. I mean, I don't say it like that.
Yeah,
To me, again, it goes back to alchemy. What have you put on wax?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what's out there?
I've already,
and there's lots out there. I appreciate you sent me demos at one point, too. Like, I love stuff that's raw.
Yeah.
Like, I've tried to place that. It's beautiful.
I got archives of songs.
Bring it on, man. I ain't scared.
Yeah, right on.
Like, I love, if for film, you live in the space. The space has flavor.
Right.
And when you feel the fret and when you feel, like, the emptiness, it's beautiful. I love reprising things.
So
starting, you know, with the sort of demo version loose.
And
then come out with the song that was ultimately put out for the end scene.
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, I live for that kind of stuff. You know? There's some of my four-track recordings when I use cassette recordings, I have them all. My four-track needs, I needed to have a doctor fix it, a four-track doctor fix it.
If you're out there.
But that never ceases to be magic. Like, I have a demo studio that I work on now, and I want it as simple as I can because, like, man, when you catch those demos, when you catch those, like, creamy, beautiful moments, and you're not paying too much attention to the sonics yet.
Yeah.
But somehow you made some really choice decisions just on the fly.
It's the magic in the room.
Yeah.
And that's how you know, Charlie, who played Townes Van Zandt in the film, he ended up producing the album. So you would lay all these things on him, and you decide, or did you just send him that you want?
Charlie's really smart, and we've known each other for a couple of years, but I think we both know each other pretty good.
It's maybe an understatement of the year.
Some other dimension, you know. But Charlie, I sent him 20 songs, right? And he was like, this is what we're going to do, dude. You send me 10, or you send me 20, or send me whatever you want. We're going to choose 10. I think he thought I'd send him 12, but I sent 20. So he
came back. We're making a double album, boys.
Yeah, and he picked 10, and I arm wrestled him over one. I was like, I want this one instead of that one. So he picked, and ended up picking 9, and I swapped one out. And he was really true to my demos, but he expanded on the idea. He pushed out the parameters for what certain things could do, all in the essence of my demos, but they became multi-tiered and 10-dimensional.
Sure as fuck.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Charlie's way of working is what you're talking about, that magic in the moment. He's technically sound to do all sorts of techniques, et cetera, but he's searching for, we're going to do this.
Well, how are we going to go back to the story?
Right.
The root of what Ben put out there,
that's
how
exactly
are we going to complement
right.
that?
That's exactly right.
And to me, it's each word. Like, it's surgical, you know?
That's what I was after. That's what I was after.
So these pieces start almost priny and then move into the petty.
They say, yeah, I appreciate that. I'll take that. Yeah. I mean, you know, my influences are not hard to find.
Woke up deep in the middle of the night. In my sleep, I was writing on the walls and the whys and the spite. In spite of myself. Heaven could be heaven and hell could be hell. All time torn asunder, reminiscing in an old hotel.
Well, the album is A Glimmer on the Outskirts, and it was recorded 2017 and released just recently on Sex Talk Black on Dual Tone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I believe, or most of it was actually recorded at Arlen Studios. Right?
All of it was recorded.
All of it.
Yeah.
And that's where we first met. You did the Texas Electric Jam for us in South By.
That was fun.
That was great, man. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Played outdoors to a bunch of people. Like, hopefully you'll see some same faces out here.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, so good time. So Arlen's studio, that's Willie's studio.
Yeah, man. And sweet, sweet vibes.
Is that the only place it had to happen? Because there's magic in that. In those,
you know, the folks who own it are so dear. And Charlie, I think, thought that was going to be perfect. And he works there so often. And, you know, it was my first time ever being in that place. And I was damn sure I knew what it was. You know,
does Bob record there?
No, but you know, Charlie lives in Austin, so he works in that studio a lot.
That's his joint.
Yeah, and this fellow who engineered it, Kyle, he works there a lot. And that room, the big room that we were using, that's just there. They know a lot of Charlie's gear is in there, and the Leslies and stuff. And anyways, it was like being home to them cats. So they were, you know, it moved very quickly, and we were very agile in that space. But I was, you know, it's world class. It's where you want to be. It's got such history. I mean, the whole time we were there, people would come through and there'd be stories. Willie's like former chief, like personnel bodyguard guy came around. I can't remember his name, but
that's the right guy to get stories
from.
Yeah,
he was wild, and his wild thing, you know, he's drinking like Dr. Pepper and moonshine. Anyways, but yeah, it's got vibes.
Real Austin afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, when I hear the Petty, especially in Way Out the Cotton.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She was only a little girl. Even the idea of little girl, I feel like that's something that, like, Petty kind of owns in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's
good. My point is they are transportive.
Is
that, like, I hear the Americana in that. I hear also the stuff that you grew up on in 1989.
Oh, yeah,
when you didn't realize who Blaze Foley really was, per se. Yeah. And you loved, maybe, we'll get into that, but, I mean, it's music. It's highly produced. It's beautiful, and it soars.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. And what at the core of it, I mean, what is the song about? We touch on cotton and stuff, and we touch on the roots of Americana music, which is black communities, gospel music, blues.
The song is about me and my sweetheart moving from Philadelphia into Northwest Louisiana and living in the middle of a cotton field. We live on my friend's farm. It's about 5,500 acres of cotton. And that's what it is.
I wait before her, wipe the sleep from my eyes. Go walk my diner, watch the sunrise. She gets up later, follows Thelma around. Swoons at the swallows, completely spellbound. She was only a little girl. She was only a little girl.
It's a beautiful tune. I think that gospel theme, like, really continues. The Monstrous Monsoon track, Come Back Down.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's a gospel song, my friend.
Something like that, right?
Is a pedal steel, the guitar in there is refraining like an outlaw in the corner of the church. Just me too, man, me too, I'm in it. And
it's ancient architecture, you know? Nobody can get away from it.
Did you grow up in the church, and was that
influence? I was around the Methodist church a little bit, and the African-American churches that were around were very inspiring to me because there was so much energy. But gospel music was always huge to me. I was a really enormous Johnny Cash fan. And
Johnny's
Elvis
got like
too.
Three albums of religious songs, per se.
I remember watching some documentary when I was like 8 or 9 about Elvis's like era in the gospel world. And I think it was on HBO, but anyways, there was this footage of the gospel choir like rehearsing this song with Elvis right after you had just seen him like practicing it alone with a guitar. And that leap with all those voices, like, I remember it like froze me, and I was like, whoa.
It's big.
Yeah.
It's big.
It's really big.
And you're seeing it like in the last few years with Radcliffe and like all those guys.
Kanye.
It's gospel, man. It's all there.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can't get away from that's it's music is medicine. Music is magic in a way, and that like you can't get away from that. You know, we shouldn't, anyways. If we're a civilized world, we shouldn't.
What should we be listening to, then?
Human voices, man.
Human voices. No, for real.
Yeah.
You know, there's something to be said about that.
If you're gonna, you know, what's the ultimate piece of music to like present to another alien culture is human voices, nothing else.
Well,
you know?
Absolutely. Do you feel like we listen to human voices? I mean, there's punk, there are all these genres we can cross through.
They're all in there. I mean, it's all in there.
But outlaw, the idea of being outlaw is like, I know there's synthetic shit. I know there's a way to the top easy. I know how to sure. write the pop songs, but I'm going to do it my fucking way and tell my story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean... That,
not really a question.
No, no, yeah. It's an observation of something that's very true. I mean...
It is outlaw. It is against the grain to do yeah. do what you do and put yourself on the line.
Right.
So when you're touring, are you touring always with this band? I know Charlie's playing with Bob Dylan. Your band is probably active.
The band that played on the record... I've only played together with live most of them, but the bass player, this fella, John Michael, he plays with me every time. I had a band, the full band, together at South By, and I just been going out solo right now because there's more aerodynamics in my pocket. My goal
Fair
is,
enough, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my goal, like, I'm trying to build something, you know. You talk about, like, building a brand. I'm trying to build an energy, and it's based on... the music that I make, but the music that I make is based on this person that I am. The person that I am is based on where I come from, and where I come from is a place that's very complicated. And I'm just trying to perpetuate that vibration because I feel like I know I'm in it and I know what it is. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I've been given a gift that there's another format that I can do it in. And it turns out that that other format is making it possible for me to have a bigger band.
But it is beautiful when you're able to touch, like, the right 25 people in a room. You know, I've seen you do that before. We're going to do it tonight. You know, and it's, I think, my favorite way to consume music now. And people like So Far Sounds are organizing these, like, bedroom concerts and whatnot.
Yeah, that is where I learned to perform. I mean, you know, like...
Yeah. But they're bringing that to the cities.
Yeah.
You know, they're bringing
it. That's good. I mean...
God bless, right?
Yeah.
As long as the artists get paid properly. I know there's a whole bullshit there.
There's always that.
Don't come at me. Who is Louis Black?
Louis Black is...
Because I'm picturing the crazy comedian.
Yeah.
Always. I'm like, you're in bed with Ethan Hawke, Charlie Sexton, and then Louis Black? What's going on?
So many people have said the same thing. It's funny because it gives the Louis Black that I'm involved with such great cover. He can sort of be like, yeah, sure, yeah. Louis Black.
Who's this mystery man?
You know, I think he made his name for himself, had the Austin Chronicle sort of like, I mean, Louis really, like South by Southwest is Louis's inception, you know.
Okay.
And Louis is a champion of multiple formats of art and film, and I think he's just always been somebody who wants to support the right kind of energy. And in Austin, he created this you know, a publication that was a voice of a culture. And you know, so hanging around in Lewis's house is fun because he's got this like archive of old Austin Chronicles, and like going back into like the 80s and 90s, there's just so crazy rich with these artists that are now positively royalty, you know?
Right.
And, but at the time that these publications came out, you know, you're talking about performing to 20 people in a room, you know, Lyle Lovett, who's such a giant voice and wonderful performer, playing for like 10, following Blaze Foley around town.
Sure.
You know, he was obsessed with Blaze, you know? And
someone else who wanted to push back,
push
past the alchemy of just albums. He acted. He was out there. He did a lot, man.
I mean, you know,
they're inspirational dudes.
We're lucky people to be.
And so Louis is preserving history in some regard. You told me about a secret project, which we cannot talk about.
Yeah.
But it's those kind of souls out there that are making it happen.
Yeah, man.
I like to think that... people in my circle are in that camp, you know, music supervisors.
It seems like it.
It doesn't matter to me often, unless I'm working on an ad, when the song came out. Does it have to be hot? Is it just perfect? Does it go back to the moment? Right now, this afternoon, I'll be looking for everything from a cover song to a new song to as old as I can go. Like maybe even 1930s will work for this crazy little character that I'm working on for an HBO thing.
Right on.
And anything goes with a network like HBO. So we're doing that work of digging. Have you met many music supervisors? Do you find us fucking strange? Are they all strange as me? Like, what? You know, because I know you're in this film world.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you,
I think you're the first.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, a friend of mine, I did some promos for this ESPN documentary about the SEC.
Okay.
And my father played college football, and I'm a fan of the game. So I was like, yeah, that sounds cool.
And the SEC and college football.
Yeah, my father...
What's that? Let's get into that for a moment.
Okay, yeah. So my father played for the University of Arkansas. He was just inducted into the University of Arkansas Hall of Fame. And,
right on.
And it was really exciting. We had to go there. And
shout his name so we can like look
David
him
Dickey, number 44.
Believe that.
Would have been a Dallas Cowboy, but his knee, he actually got, Coach Landry signed him to the team, and then he got cut after his knee was basically like, yo, I'm not a knee anymore. Fast forward to my buddy Haji asking me to do these promos, and like, you know, he was like, I don't know if it'd be your thing. In a lot of cases, it wasn't the kind of thing I'd do, but I had already known that my dad was going to be inducted. And the SEC is, you know, badass. So, I did these little promos, and they let me be my, I mean, I dressed myself, I had a guitar, they let me do this whole thing. But I think, I talked to somebody that was a music supervisor in that situation, but it was more of just like, we need the music for this, you know, it's very, you know. So you're the first person that's demonstrating passion.
Well, I mean, your songs are beautiful, and they haven't been out long enough. You know, I don't even think I have your first album, which I'd love to grab from you.
Yeah, yeah.
Voice, you know, and the way it's produced, it's not, there's nothing on the album that would feel like, oh, why are we in the Blaze movie all of a sudden?
Yeah, right.
It's nothing like that. It's a nice, it's a nice separate piece to what you do, man.
Yeah, man. It's all the sounds that are on there. It was all, you know, where my head was when I was making those demos, and that place was really swirly.
So, you know, what were you listening to at age 13?
Oh, man, I was listening to everything, Chess Records, Chuck and Jerry Lee. I mean, my father was such a big Jerry Lee fan. I listened to tons of that. My mother turned me on to George Harrison. Like, I listened to the Beatles.
Yeah.
I was wild about Jimi Hendrix. I loved Bob Marley. But the Beatles, and then George Harrison's All Things Must Pass, when I was like even younger, looking at George on the cover of a Beatles record and then looking at George on the cover of All Things Must Pass, where he looks like...
Trying to understand what happened.
Yeah, like not...
Oh, absolutely, man.
Yeah, you know, so like, I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is interesting stuff going on here.
See, that's why it's so important. I have a new intern and I keep saying, just go through the records when you're bored.
Yeah,
And just like look and see what... Try and tell stories, you know, try and make connections.
Yeah. Or,
you know, be curious. Prove yourself wrong on your own theories of what these people in your head might be. That's the greatest part about looking at shit before Instagram, and you can share everything.
Two events that were enormous in my life, music-wise, was when they put out that Robert Johnson Complete.
Oh my God, me too.
So my buddy's dad was a radio DJ, and like he got it as a promo,
sure.
And he listened to it in a couple. He was, that's cool, and I was kind of borrow that, you know.
Yeah.
That blew my mind. That was when I was like 11 or 12. Couple years after that, the Jimi Hendrix Blues album came out.
Okay.
And the cover of it is a mosaic of Jimmy made by a bunch of blues players.
I know
players.
It well, and we'll put a link in there.
And then inside of it, it tells you who all, you know, there's like 50 names.
Yeah.
And they're all blues artists from Delta Blues to St. Louis, all over. So when that record came out, I wrote all the names down and would go to record stores and be like, check, check, check.
Right.
Because if all that stuff, because, you know, the art was telling you that all that stuff made Jimi Hendrix. I was like, well, I got to know all that stuff.
I did the same thing with the Robert Parker, because remember, it was a tall box set.
Yeah, big box,
black
and
white.
But
it was like thin, right?
Yeah, the old school.
It was almost like a book you can hold.
Exactly.
It
did have a little book inside, yeah.
The book was attached, so it was like a hardcover.
Right, exactly.
And I felt like I was diving into a whole world. I had the classic Robert Johnson picture on the front.
Yeah, man.
So evocative. That was life-changing for me around 13.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Obsessively so.
And I remember my dad bought it along with tin box, or what were they called? The tin machine.
Tin machine.
Bowie's.
Da Bowie. Yeah.
I remember the two long boxes coming at me. And so at 21, we like to do these jumps on the podcast.
Yeah,
so 13, 21.
All that stuff I was listening to.
Are you playing football at 21?
I'm playing basketball.
Played basketball?
Yeah, I played basketball.
No hockey players came out of Arkansas. You
know? No, but my nephew is a goalie in Princeton. He plays for Princeton.
For real,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah, yeah, he's bad at.
Right on, I'm a goalie too.
So all that music, I'm 21, all that music is still with me. But now I'm listening to Fugazi a lot. Fugazi, huge, huge, huge influence on me. Drive Like Jehu. The Benz, Radiohead's The Benz came out, I think, when I was 21.
Huge, right?
Huge. I think I discovered Harry Nilsson around that time.
Okay, interesting.
All the Beatles solo stuff. And you know, my imagination had grown to where I was just like, T-Bone Walker was an enormous, like, I had to get everything to, you know, the older I got, if I liked something, I had to get everything.
Right.
I had to get everything.
Absolutely,
you know?
Man. And also sticking to the rabbit holes of the stuff you had already grew up on and were.
Yeah.
And so now you're busier, life's changed, you know.
Yeah, certainly.
I don't know if you're quite 40 yet. I'm loving my 40s.
I'm 42, 40s. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, same, man. I'm loving this time of my life.
Yeah.
And in this era of Spotify and vinyl at the same time, the discovery is easy. What are you listening to now?
I fall into the habit of listening to like Fats Domino, Alan Toussaint. I listen to a lot of Django Reinhardt.
Okay.
But I'm open to all sorts of different things.
But you're really interested in virtuosity right now.
Maybe so. Fats is.
Because those are virtuosos.
Yeah, Fats to me is like. It's some sort of groove when Fats playing where I'm like, I gotta get like, it helps me, like, reminds myself that, like,
what a pocket is.
Yeah, well, like that. Oh my gosh, I gotta get, like, there's this record called Party Time in New Orleans that's like all these different Alan Toussaint recordings from like 59 to like 64, and they're all party songs.
Sure.
2.5 minutes long, but you could play them for 25 minutes and there's, I don't understand how they're not now or ever were the biggest thing in the world.
Right. What was the most life-changing movie for you? Growing up,
Hard Day's Night.
Hard Day's Night,
yeah, without a doubt.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt. I mean,
what about that?
Before, just seeing
like the Beatles, or just like seeing them being
them.
Goofs. Like,
all the train scenes and Paul's grandfather character and Ringo going out by himself, and then the music. And then that they're on the run, and that it was so beautiful and black and white and simple.
And non-narrative in a way.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. When I first discovered that movie, I was just discovering Charlie Chaplin.
Okay.
And Buster Keaton. And that was kind of like via PBS. And,
yeah,
you know what I mean? But they all seemed to be the same.
Yeah.
Like I think it was in 99, they put that movie back out, mastered, and they did the film all up. I went and saw it 3 times in one day.
Amazing.
I had dinner in the middle of it.
What's your film now? The one that, like, I need you to see this film.
Hard
if you're a friend of mine, you need to see this film.
Let me think about that. You know, I guess this is the one that comes to mind and is Being There. Peter Sellers. That
again, in the whole Beatles world, right?
Yeah, like, you know, it's funny.
That's a big life-changing film for me, man.
It's huge. And then The Party is also... There's something about Peter Sellers that, you know, I was a chef for some time. And there's something about, you talk about like virtuosity and somebody like masters.
Like not just a cook, you were a chef.
No, I was a chef, yeah. I ran 2 restaurants.
Oh.
It took part of my brain.
Oh man, that's gotta be harder than anything we do.
Anything I've ever done in my life, yeah. it was, I'm glad I did it, but anyways. There's something about watching Sellers where I'm like, that dude has put in so many hours.
That's what it is, man.
Yeah.
It's 10,000 hours.
10,000 hours.
It's forgetting it, to know it, to connect on a different fucking level, to work the spaces between the words, you know?
Yeah.
Is that how you and Ethan connected over films? Like, you knew him well before this movie.
Yeah. You know, our sweethearts were friends, good friends. So we kind of went on like a play date, you know? It was like... You know, the first time I ever met him, I was coming home from, I was a sous chef, and his wife now was graduating from college, and they had rented like a Red Roof Inn to kind of have like a pretend high school party, you know, because she was, you know, graduating. And I was greasy as could be, and, you know, had been working on the line, a 7-hour line shift. And I came home, was greasy, and like they were just drunk and celebrating. And we started talking that night. And of course, I knew who he was. I was a fan. You know?
Sure.
But I've never been a Star Trek person, and I was more interested in whether or not he was going to be a good person for my friend Ryan to be dating.
You're a good man, Ben.
Yeah. So I'd
be weary too.
Yeah. Me and my sweetheart were like, you know, side eye, like, what you up to, man?
And you gotta be careful, those really two good looking guys, man, with those eyes. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a Frank Sinatra thing.
Yeah.
So, then the next time we hung out was the next night, and it was like a more formal party. that the parents were throwing, and there was family and neighbors and friends and such. And but it was Game 7, Lakers Spurs. Game 6, Lakers Spurs 04, I guess. And I was like, I kind of need to. Is this a cool party? But
I gotta go.
Gotta go check out what's gonna. So I was the one who snuck away and found a TV, and he was like, whoa, and he found it, and then he got in big trouble for sneaking away and
watching. It's worth it.
But that was the night I was like, oh, this dude's all right. This dude's all right. So, but we're both Southerners, you know. We had a bunch of stuff to like.
So you connected through all that.
And then over the years, we just got to be closer. And he got to watch him know what I was trying to do as a musician. And I got to watch the choices he made as an artist who was already a well-known artist and the pressure that comes with that. But also the risks that he took and the chances he said no to, things that he said no to that he didn't, you know. It was interesting, you know.
Yeah, he's just truly an artist.
Yeah, yeah. He's, you know, he says all the time, like, he read this. When we went to Switzerland last year, they had just put out the documentary about Dennis Hopper. And Ethan had met Hopper some years ago, and he said something to the effect of, you know, when I was a kid, I just wanted to be in the building that said the arts. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't care what it was. I just wanted to be, I don't go
what's
work.
Happening. I want to be part of it.
Yeah.
I'm the same way, man. Yeah.
And so that was an interesting thing. And then we had been talking about, we would kick around this whole idea of Townes Van Zandt, Blaze Foley, and like Billy Joe Shaver, and all these different characters, and how wonderful they all are, and how if you could make a really interesting series episodically.
Amazing.
And focus on the songs.
Yeah.
He and I would just talk about that, like, never with, like, and then you could put me in there, dude. Like, it was
like
never.
Each episode is an Outlaws tune broken down kind of thing.
Bro, well, yeah, you pick a song and you pick a true episode of their life. Billy Joe's got tons. Waylon's got tons. Blaze has tons. And you make a little episodic video, and it doesn't even have to be like them it's happening to.
Sure.
It could be happening to other characters. Yeah. This is the way Ethan and I would talk, and I was like, oh man, you could take this song, and da 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 da. So we would always talk about that and add to the idea. And really, at no point was it, and then you could get me to be Blaze Foley. That came much later and out of the blue, literally. I mean, literally out of the blue. No warm-up to it. Just like, he looked at me and was like, this is what's going to happen.
But did he know all these connections and run them down for me? Because it's silly.
No, man. We didn't. I mean, we truly didn't.
Because you're born in the same place.
Well, I'm
people
born...
People you knew Sybil.
Yeah.
And
like, people... Alia knew Sybil.
Alia knew Sybil.
Right, well, Alia had a connection.
And you didn't know Alia before, and she was just your choice based on acting alone. And she knew Sybil?
Yeah, she
that's crazy.
Someone in her life went to high school with Sybil.
Okay.
The day that Ethan Skyped with Alia to pitch the movie, right?
Okay.
She said, yeah, really quickly. And I was there, but I had taken a walk because we were all nervous. And at this point, it's still like it's not a real thing. Like, Ethan's trying to get the pieces together to then go get the money to make it
happen.
As
is the film business,
exactly,
man. It's
exactly.
Like, you got so many balls.
So she left that little Skype meeting and went to have a lunch meeting with, I think, one of her agents and then a friend that she had been knowing, an actress that she'd been knowing her whole life, that she'd, you know, Ali has been acting since she's a little kid.
Okay.
So this person was at that, and she told him, I just got on the Skype with Ethan Hawke and I'm doing this thing. And her friend was like, oh my God. And she pulled her phone up and was like, keep talking, and said, showed her a picture. And it was her and Sybil at the age of 16 at the beach in North Carolina, because they're good friends.
For real?
Yes. And she was like, what the hell?
That's chills, man.
And she said, the kismet, like,
meant
diamonds in my blood were just like, wow. Like, and she told Ethan right away, but those kind of things would happen over and over again.
Blaze feels transcendent. It feels like it's from a group of films that recently are coming out or came out, you know,
right.
Paradox. You see Neil Young's sort of non-narrative sprawling outlaw tales.
Right.
These intimate stories of relationships are just different.
Right.
It blew my mind, man, the whole Jewish connection to outlaw music.
Yeah.
I mean, every day, look at me. Like, I got my rings, I got my shit going on, I got my boots, but like, I always feel a little inadequate because of my Judaism, if I'm being honest.
my sweetheart's Jew. So.
There you go, man. But that film was so vindicating for me. It was
something?
It was great to see that. And I know that, you know, my culture is a culture that borrows heavily from everything around it. Like, we suck in everything because we're a nomadic people.
Yeah.
Right? And so we love the underdog music so much, the blues, the gospel, you know? We love to support that stuff. And the connection made to me, just, I don't even know if there's a question there, but God bless for flushing out that.
Yeah.
Picking that outlaw story of all of them, Ethan, you know?
Yeah.
Big love to you, man, because it means a lot to me, that film now.
Yeah, it means a lot to me in so many ways.
I'm sure.
And I know so many people who are so profound in certain ways about them that they'll never get, not that they deserve to be pat on the head for it, but Blaze is somebody who, you know, he torpedoed his own ship, but it was because he was woeful about a lot of things in this world. But there's so many people who are like Blaze in the sense that they're not trying to be famous or trying to get, but they have something really important to show you and tell you.
It's super special. It's super important. Everyone's voice is important.
Yeah, man.
And I think that film really aligns people who feel like outsiders.
Yeah.
You know, that there is not only something for you, an outlet for music to go beyond your means and whatever, but there's a woman that will love you for who you are, man.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing for young men
who
feel alone. And they feel like Lucille's their only thing. All they got there is guitar, you know?
Yeah.
But there's always somebody who's going to connect with the wildest, craziest outsider person who may be sad.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And what does Sybil think of this film now? Have you spoken to her?
We're in touch all the time. She texts me today. One of the most amazing parts about making the movie was that I connected with her. Sybil and I are best of friends, you know.
Beautiful.
For about 6 weeks before we started filming, and then she came to set. She was present on set every day.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And not in a this isn't right way.
Yeah, not fact checking just feeling.
Pushing.
Right.
Helping.
Is it going back to the core of who Blaze is and
breakup
what our story
scene.
Is?
She's like, that is not at all how it happened, but it's exactly what happened.
Exactly. It's a way to express it, yeah.
So for about 6 weeks, we wrote each other, and like I was in that preparation world, and it's hard. I was doing it alone. I didn't have any reading partners, low budget. I mean, you know, I was a location scout to an extent for this project. So having these little postcards, if you will, digital postcards, come every day was really exciting. But it wasn't. It was all about me and her. It wasn't the little Blazisms and little truths that she told me were certainly helpful to the process, but we were bonding in a bit different way. And so when we met each other, we had this connection that never stopped, where we're talking and sharing. And she's an artist, you know, and she's an artist in the sense that she's brave as hell and scared as hell too, you know, at the same time.
Yeah.
And
did she write the core of this story? Like, was she compiling the stories of her life before she met Ethan?
She wrote a book in 2004. It came out in 2004. When she found out Blaze had died, she found out listening to the radio.
Okay.
And it was 12 years after he died that she found out. And when she found out that he died...
Watch the film to find out how.
Right. We show the gunshot in the trailer. She kind of went back and learned more about what happened to him, because as far as she knew, when he left Chicago, he like kind of went back to doing not much, but come to find out he'd gotten close with Towns and he'd written these songs, and Willie and Merle had like, holy cow, you know, like the one of Willie's daughters who found Blaze and gave Willie the tape of If I Could Only Fly, like all those little magical things that started to happen, and the people's lives who he touched, the relationships that he had, she started to learn all about that stuff. And came to find out that he always kept with him a picture of her, and it never left his person. He died with it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so, but.
So she's discovering this stuff, and it's calling to her.
Right, yeah. I mean,
then she meets this guy born in the same fucking place, with the same build, not the same walk, but you know. You're a presence, man, you know?
Yeah.
And apparently, so is Blaze. Like, people knew who he was miles away, kind of.
Right.
Thing, you know?
The thing that I had wrong before I got to meet Sybil was the limp. I had totally had a different, I had a whole different thing in my head. And she showed me what the limp looked like. So I got it exactly right based on what she told me. And so many people have come up to me, especially people that live in Austin, had closeness with Blaze. And they would just get teary, you know, like talking to me, because
it's
they're like, the way that you moved, like, as soon as I saw you moving, it's like, it really shook me. And I believed them, and it's touching, it's overwhelming sometimes, but it's heavy, man, it's beautiful.
And you can't know that, you just gotta like,
trust
them by their eyes, like you nailed it, right?
Yeah.
Blaze wasn't out there, like you said, he kind of, before his time, before people let him soar and said, like, let's work together. And
yeah, you know, it's that damn biker speed, man.
Biker speed debts, bullshit, you know?
Yeah, man.
You got to live outlaw, but you got to live, man.
Yeah.
You got to live. What song are you going to go out on? What song are we going to end this podcast on?
How about we end it on Even If, the last song on the record?
You heard it from the man himself. Well, Ben Dickey, thanks for joining me at the H Club. A Glimmer on the Outskirts on Dual Tone is available at Ben Dickey Music on all your formats. Go steal it if you can find a crack version of LimeWire, but fucking get your hands on it, man. And go down the rabbit hole. Discover John Prine. Discover Blaze Foley. Watch the film. Big love to Ethan. Big love to Sybil, Alia, all our friends that made that project happen. And thank you, Ben, for joining us.
Thanks, David.
Cheers, brother.
Cheers, man.
Even if you don't remember my face, even if you erase me from your memory, and even if there's no flies a-fluttering, even if there's no love left in your beaten heart for me, well, I've been working on high, hot tears in my eyes since you put me outside. But I guess I hurt you, I regret it, I hope you know. You were gone forever though. supper time. And even if you give away all of my bones, even if you need me now to help you out in your joy and pain, he still wants me to go. I'm so thrilled, you're the one I adore. I'm a dog for you, gal. You was my best pal. I just had to go, 'cause no.
Music Supercast is a production of Sorrel Studios and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.